Hello, this is Byron Richards, and you are tuned in to my weekly wellness update podcast, the health news and views that you can actually use. Well, we've got a busy week here to cover, and we'll just dive right on in and get started. The first article of the week was entitled Zinc, Alcohol Damage, and Thyroid Function. Fascinating new animal study out which showed that zinc supplementation was able to guard against the adverse effects of alcohol during pregnancy, including the prevention of stillbirths and mortality early in life. Well, this is a huge finding. You know, yes, it is an animal study. This study will not be repeated in humans in this way because it wouldn't be appropriate to do so. But the finding that zinc could completely stop alcohol in problems in pregnancy is a major finding to society. This should be on the front pages of every newspaper. Any woman of potential pregnancy age who is drinking should know about this because it is capable of, you know, I mean, maybe you don't even know you're pregnant and you're going out in here and you're drinking. You should have zinc before you go. 25 to 50 milligrams of zinc ahead of time. Very highly protective. We know from human studies that alcohol, people who drink a lot have low levels of zinc. That's a problem. And we also know that zinc enhances liver function, protects the liver, and helps actually boost the enzyme aldehyde dehydrogenase, which clears the alcohol. So it has already a bunch of science showing how it helps with alcohol, but this is a very important finding. It also means just, you know, besides the issue of pregnancy, it's for anybody who has a drink or two, or maybe sometimes more, you don't want to be deficient in zinc. If you're deficient in zinc, your liver is more likely to be sensitive to liver-related injury from alcohol. So zinc is the key here, and that's very, very important. It also means that if you drink too much and you're zinc deficient, you could end up with a thyroid problem from alcohol drinking. And so that's an interesting thing here, because we also know that zinc is needed. I mean, zinc's involved with a lot of things: your immune system, your sense of smell, hearing, taste, balance, skin, complexion. I mean, there's many things, sex drive. It's a lot of things zinc are involved with. But it is also a key mineral that begins the production of thyroid hormone in the hypothalamus gland of your brain. So zinc is needed to actually get the production of thyroid-releasing hormone going in the first place. And that's, you know, an issue for a lot of people. It also participates with nutrients like selenium to convert the T4 to T3. So we know zinc is a player in metabolism and in immunity and in liver health and in detoxification of metals, especially lead, cadmium, mercury. All of those things require zinc-related enzymes. But alcohol is the key here, and since so many people do consume some alcohol, just don't run low on zinc. All right, another study out, sleep desire, caffeine, and inflammation. Very interesting here, but the desire you have to go to sleep when you're tired. In other words, how do you know you're tired, besides the obvious fact that you're tired? But what's going on in your brain? Well, you're raising a compound. This is now what the scientists have found, that adenosine is being elevated in your nervous system as the day goes along, and when it reaches a certain level of adenosine, then you want to go to sleep. Now, adenosine, it's interesting because adenosine is a pivotal molecule. It can go on to become other things besides just itself. It can become adenosine triphosphate, which is called ATP, or energy. It's what your body is making during the day that keeps you awake. So at some point during the day, your body quits turning adenosine into energy in your cells' engines, and it starts saying, well, no, we don't want to make energy anymore. We're just going to leave adenosine, the basic sort of starting material, elevated, and that's what makes you tired. Well, that's a very interesting finding. And the question is, well, how does your body know to do that? Well, it appears that inflammation, or just the wear and tear of the day, as inflammation starts to increase, then adenosine levels elevate and there's less conversion to energy. Well, you know, that's great for just the normal idea of, well, now we need some sleep. But it also points to the very interesting fact that if you are already inflamed from extra wear and tear, stress, you know, not eating well, whatever it might happen to be, your body's going to start behaving too soon or too early, or even maybe at the beginning of the day, that it's time for you to go to bed because you're not turning adenosine into energy. Your body's acting as if you've already been through an entire day based on the level of inflammation. So it's interesting how that works. It has been found, and of course everybody knows, that caffeine keeps them awake, and it acts directly to suppress the place on nerve cells where adenosine would bind. So the receptors where adenosine binds are blocked by caffeine, and that's why caffeine promotes wakefulness. So does chocolate, for the same reason. And so do some purine-rich foods. And these would include things such as animal organs, seafood, pork, red meat. Those are probably your top ones there. So people who are inflamed and who eat, if you eat too many of the purines, it will keep you up like chocolate and caffeine. It's probably not quite as strong, but it's a factor. So if you eat those at night and you're prone to having sleep problems, it might be an issue for you. Point here is you need to get your sleep. You want to not have inflammation during the day because otherwise you'll find yourself gravitating to caffeine and chocolate and you end up eating too much, which of course will make you gain weight because you end up being tired and you're not making energy. So the solution, of course, is getting your inflammation levels down. If you get your inflammation levels down, then your adenosine doesn't stay there and doesn't make you tired as much. So that's an important new understanding that we have on the sleep issue. Bottom line, less inflammation. Another related posting I did as long as I was on the sleep issue, there were actually a few interesting ones that did come out in the news this past week. Too much or too little sleep is inflammatory. Well, we know the right amount of sleep for an adult is somewhere between 7 to 8 hours. And of course, when you don't get enough sleep, you're going to be more tired. It's going to be harder to get through the day. And sure enough, that elevated a particular inflammatory marker, which was TNFA, or tumor necrosis factor alpha, elevated by 8% from a lack of sleep. So once again, you're just getting yourself into an inflamed mode from a lack of sleep, which will then, according to the other study I just mentioned, make you more tired and during the day. But they also found, the researchers in the study, that when you slept one more hour than the eight, so if you slept 9 hours, for each hour extra you slept, inflammation of a different kind, your C-reactive protein, went up by 8%. So really, you need to get a good night's sleep. You need to get into a condition of a good night's sleep. Part of that is managing your inflammation during the day so you're ready to go to sleep at the right time and not trying to, you know, be tired all day and now you can't sleep when it comes time. So stress, being overweight, eating poorly, too many chemicals in your diet, pollution, poor lifestyle, all these things are on the side of inflammation that will end up causing you to get into a situation where either you sleep too little or sleep too much, and either one is not good. So you want to work on that as part of the overall plan. Now, quality of sleep is needed for memory and learning. And this is a new emerging body of data that we're seeing here. It's that when you're going to school or reading or learning anything that you're learning on your own, that day when you're analyzing it and thinking about it and integrating it, it's sort of in a short-term memory system, kind of like a day memory system, you might say, and it hasn't fully integrated yet. And your plasticity and ability to absorb that information and integrate it into long-term memory is very much dependent on sleep. In other words, when you go to sleep and you're sleeping well, various gene switches are turned on during sleep, which are now proven to integrate and consolidate information. Well, of course, this is very important for anybody who has to learn new things, students going to school and so on. You've got to get enough sleep or you simply will not retain memory correctly. It's one of the reasons I like phosphatidylserine before bed, which is a great memory compound anyway for learning and so on. But it's really good before bed if you have learned a lot that day and so on. You know, it really helps you to sleep quite well. Nice trick, but just whether you take a nutrient or not to help with this, the idea is quality sleep will help you to be more intelligent and remember things. So that's a good point. So we're seeing here that sleep is just so important, and getting yourself in the condition for quality sleep is vital, not only to your health so that you're not inflamed and elevating these inflammatory wear and tear markers, but also for your ability to maintain and continue to learn, which I think everybody agrees these days, nobody's ever learned too much. Got to keep getting more skills, got to keep learning, got to keep adapting to the changing world in which we live, which requires that every one of us never become idle as far as learning. All right, I did an article this week, again, relating to American Heart Month, which is on DHA, the important omega-3 fatty acid of fish oil. DHA is a 22-carbon-long fatty acid with 6 unsaturated bonds. It is the most biologically active fatty acid that's in fish oil. We know that. And, you know, fish oil itself has now been conclusively proven to reduce 45% the rate of heart arrhythmias that result in potential cardiovascular heart attacks, including for people who've already had one. It helps prevent a second one. So we know that fish oil is now one of the really completely proven nutrients. And there's a couple of things about this. One, the essential fatty acids, which would be in animals if they ran around and eat grass. We don't have a lot of animals like that are range-raised anymore. And if we do, of course, they have omega-3s in their fat. But because we don't have so much, that puts a lot of strain on fish oil. Most of the vegetarian sources of omega-3 fatty acids, such as flax, flax oil or chia seeds, I mean, that's fine to have that in your diet if you like, but they do not convert very easily or efficiently into the amount of DHA that you actually need for cardiovascular health. So it really leaves individuals the option of eating fish. And if you have 4 ounces of fish a day, as a lot of the Japanese men do, you have half the rate of heart disease, even if your cholesterol is high or whatever. It's just the one variable. If you eat 4 ounces of fatty fish a day, you are much less likely to have heart disease. That's a proven fact in these Japanese men, and they compared them in the one study that was done to Japanese men living in America and who were not eating that much fish, and they were more, well, they were the same as American men. So the point being here is that there's a certain level of omega-3 fatty acids which can be consumed in the diet. They can be then measured in your blood. And when you hit an amount of them, you are afforded extreme cardiovascular protection. The fatty acids also help to lower your triglycerides at very or much higher levels, but higher levels. They help your white adipose tissue so that it's healthier. It actually helps your stored fat make adiponectin, which is a hormone that prevents type 2 diabetes. But very, very much part of a weight loss plan. I mean, essential fatty acids by themselves, I wouldn't call them the only weight loss nutrient or that kind of thing, but they very much help to condition your metabolism to behave correctly and can even rescue you from heading into a path of obesity and definitely can rescue your metabolism from type 2 diabetes. So one of the key things about this is that you actually get enough of these in your diet. And so a couple different things here. When you're looking at fish oil, only a percent of it is the DHA. Usually it's between 10 and 20% of the fish oil. Kind of depends on what fish oils are used and how fatty they are. So, for example, when you're eating salmon or tuna, you're up around 20% of the fat in salmon or tuna is DHA. If you have a less fatty fish, it might be around 10% or none in some of the shallow water fish. In other words, the fish make these fatty acids because they're in cold ocean waters, and they're used for insulation. That's why they make them in the first place. So if you have fish living along the equator or shallow water fish, they don't have much essential fatty acids. So it's not the same thing. That's why you want the fatty fish. Of course, we have the issue with the mercury and other PCBs, toxins, fat-soluble toxins that are in a lot of the fish. That's a big problem. So the government, of course, is now saying, well, now don't eat fish more than twice a week because of how toxic it is, and, you know, why the government doesn't actually test fish from different areas and provide guidelines in terms of the source of fish is beyond me. They just, I don't know. I mean, what I'll do personally when I'm out eating fish, I put lots of lemon on it because lemon's a good chelator of mercury. It's a weak acid that's very good detoxifier. So lemon on your fish is always protective. If you're thinking about it, you can take some chlorella, which will absorb mercury. So if you know you're going to have a fish that night, you might take a couple capsules of chlorella or daily balancer before you go out to dinner, and you'll get some chlorella in there that will be protective. So you can kind of protect yourself from it. When I make the dietary supplements with the DHA in them, I, of course, use molecularly distilled fish oil so that all the mercury, all the PCBs, all the toxins are out of the oil completely. And that, of course, then gives you a product with purity. And the other thing I do is I concentrate the DHA, which is the important fatty acid. In regular fish oil, EPA is about 50% higher than the DHA. And EPA, you know, it can compete for DHA getting into your brain. EPA is not the main fat that you need in your cell membranes to regulate function of your body, your circulatory system, or inflammation on cells. It's the DHA that's critically important. So when we modify and distill the fish oil, it ends up being 50% DHA and 10% EPA instead of, say, 50%. Well, it's usually about 10% DHA and 15% EPA, something along those lines. At any rate, the point here is you need a certain amount of DHA a day. And the ideal amount for basic cardiovascular protection is at least 400 milligrams of DHA. Now, that's not 400 milligrams of fish oil, mind you, because fish oil is only partly DHA. So you have to look at the labels of products. And so 400 milligrams of DHA is what you want as a basic dose. And that ranges all the way up to a high-level therapeutic dose of 2,000 milligrams of DHA a day, which can optimize the ability. Your blood really can't hold more or handle more than that. It kind of optimizes the levels. So if you're really trying to maximize DHA levels to help with your triglycerides or to stabilize blood pressure, to help platelets be less, to help them flow better, to help your circulation, you might want to go up higher. It just depends on what your needs are. For anyone, because these are very important for growth and regulation of health, even children should be getting somewhere between 100 and 300 milligrams of DHA a day. It's very difficult to get in the diet, and thus supplementation, even just 100 milligrams a day, is wonderful. So that's very important. In my article, which I did up, a very thorough article with many, many studies in it, it was entitled DHA Krill Oil and Green Lip Muscle, Which Is Best? I wrote this because there's been a lot of hype out there about things like krill oil. I got no objection to krill oil, except it's really expensive. Very few studies on it. It's kind of a monopoly from one Canadian company, so you end up paying way more than you need to, and each capsule of it only has 40 milligrams of DHA. So it doesn't, unless you take 10 capsules a day, you don't even get to a proven level of what you need, which is incredibly expensive. It's over 7 times the price of molecularly distilled DHA from fish oil. And so, with krill oil, you have something with a handful of studies, and the key studies that are referred to are studies that were put out in one alternative medicine magazine or journal, that's owned by the owner of that journal also owns a company that sells krill oil. So, you know, it's one of those things. There's not a lot of credibility here in that kind of work. And we're comparing a product, krill oil, which doesn't have any large-scale studies of any kind and doesn't have any science whatsoever to show that it can prevent heart disease, whereas fish oil has now a lot of studies, which is what I went over in this article. Green lip mussel, likewise, that's just outrageous what's going on there. But you see these claims, and a lot I get asked these questions all the time by people, well, why, you know, green lip mussel is 250 times more powerful than fish oil. Why do I need fish oil? Well, the green lip mussel network marketing company has exaggerated beyond belief the idea that green lip mussel has some sort of super duper whooper DHA in it that's so powerful it's like unbelievable. Well, there's no such thing as DHA is DHA. It's not like one is powerful and one isn't. And so, you know, these people are so bad that the green lip mussel in one of their capsules is around 1 milligram, which is nothing. Yet, I mean, it's just beyond comprehension. Anyway, if you like to know more about that, I've written about it in great detail. My take-home message for American Heart Healthy Month is that you need DHA. DHA in young people has been proven to improve their circulation and even prevent, you know, it helps them not go down a path of a problem. So you want it in your kids' diets. A DHA capsule, which contains 135 milligrams, is perfect for any kid, one a day. If you have a child who has got a little bit of learning issue or is trying to maximize, I mean, you can take like extra DHA. This is great for the brain to help with attention problems, or for students who are really bent on being higher achievers, it will help them on the ability side. So you've got different angles and reasons why somebody wants it, but you want a certain amount in there as a basic thing just for basic brain health, cognitive function, and circulation. And then depending on your situation, the older you get, the, you know, especially if you're overweight or your triglycerides are up or your blood pressure's up, that kind of thing, you'd want to be having higher doses. Otherwise, you can get by, you know, at age 50 or over with around 400 milligrams of DHA a day. So that gives you the guidelines for this, but it's very, very important to get enough DHA. So look at your labels, look at your bottles, add it up, and see where you're at. Okay, we're going to move now to the questions for the week. We have a number of questions from our listeners, and certainly if you have a question, feel free to email it to me, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The first question this week comes from Sue, who says, I have been reading about pH levels in the body, and this particular book recommends drinking alkaline water, using hydrogen peroxide drops or other alkaline drops, in between meals to raise alkalinity in the body and help to neutralize the acid waste, in combination with a more alkaline diet. Could you please give your opinion on the use of hydrogen peroxide or other alkaline drops? Well, Sue, I've never been short on giving my opinions about things, so I'm happy to give my opinion. Hydrogen peroxide, which has extra oxygen released when it's used, and the goal here and the idea of this alkalinizing of water is to basically add more oxygen in a way that the hydrogen is connected to more oxygen so that the pH, the hydrogen isn't concentrated, which makes pH more acid. So that's kind of the theory behind it. I have a little bit of a problem with hydrogen peroxide. I mean, you're going to get a hydrogen peroxide's a germicidal bleaching compound. I mean, it does that because the oxygen is free, and it basically is you're going to have antioxidants to deactivate it. So I have no idea why anybody would use hydrogen peroxide as a strategy to improve their alkalinity. Alkaline drops, I'm not sure which product you're referring to, but they're usually like minerals or mineral ions of some kind. I don't have a problem with those. If you want to put them in your water, go right ahead. But keep in mind that it's not something I tell people to go out and do simply because, you know, you take minerals, and you're going to get a lot of trace minerals with good mineral products. You're going to get the potassium and the magnesium and the calcium and your other trace minerals by just taking minerals. And you're going to get plenty of what we call the alkaline buffering minerals in your dietary supplements. And, of course, in your diet from eating fresh fruits and vegetables, you get these things. So to me, I don't get involved with this kind of alkalinizing of water. I've, of course, done lots of research with water over the years. Was fascinated by, geometrically changing water and this kind of thing. But I long ago gave up on it and just say to people, hey, purify your water. Don't drink tap water. Reverse osmosis is fine as far as I'm concerned. Just get it cleaner so you're not drinking a bunch of garbage. And so now, as far as this whole thing about alkalinity, that's a whole other issue in and of itself. Yes, of course, you need a more alkaline diet. But people get really confused about this because they, all these diet books that talk about alkalinity, they're all attacking protein, which potentially has an acid ash residue. So that's where this all gets very confusing for people. And the point I always like to make is that when your muscles are being used and when you're active, you can eat a lot of protein and you end up alkaline. Very important for people to understand. Things like sugar and junk food and chips and a bunch of fried foods and garbage foods and fast foods will make you extremely inappropriately acid. But important point, protein does not, especially if you use your muscles and you eat them with buffering minerals, which that's why you eat protein with fruit and vegetables or you have these things in your diet so you're not lacking. All right, Jan says, I'm 30 pounds overweight and I have a lot of the symptoms of low thyroid, except I am always too hot and sweat too much. I don't have symptoms of hyperthyroid. Why am I so hot? Well, Jan, when you're overweight, one of the things that happens is your body is trying to figure out how to get rid of calories. Now, one of the ways to get rid of calories is to make them into energy, which would give you 65% energy and 35% heat. That's while you maintain your body temperature, normal energy production. So when you're not making energy at a normal rate, then you're cold because that 35% heat isn't being made, and that's how come people with low thyroid are oftentimes cold. But you're saying, of course, you have these symptoms. You're tired, you're sluggish, a little bit heavy-headed. You might be constipated, that kind of thing. But you're hot. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means that your body is throwing away calories as a defense mechanism. In other words, you're not actually converting calories to energy, maybe because you're not active enough, maybe because you're not doing things. But even when you do things, you'll notice you sweat more, get hot too easily. And so your system is always on the verge of trying to just turn calories into heat. And this is really a defense mechanism. It's kind of a last-ditch effort to prevent fat from clogging everything in your body. And so, yes, you have to follow the leptin diet and not snack between meals and not eat after dinner. That will help you immensely. But the key here is to prevent what's called metabolic uncoupling, which is what this problem is. And you can do that with extra antioxidants of almost any kind. So like Daily Protector, Daily Balancers, Daily Super E. I mean, so many nutrients have antioxidants. I mean, you can take any antioxidants you have around and just take enough of them, and you will find at a certain level you will quit being so hot and you will quit sweating so easily. This is true for anybody who's overweight and is too hot. So you still may be low thyroid underneath it all, but the reason you're hot isn't because of the low thyroid. It's because your body is trying to throw away calories as a last-ditch effort defense mechanism. All right, Mike says, I am a 51-year-old male who takes tons of supplements. Among them is pregnenolone and DHEA. I use these 2 months on and 1 month off. What do you know or think about this? Well, both pregnenolone and DHEA are adrenal hormone precursors. I did research on pregnenolone some 20 years ago. We used it extensively in much higher doses with women, and it gave them a lot of breakthrough bleeding with their menstrual cycle, so we quit doing it. But pregnenolone for men is, it's an example of an adrenal precursor. I don't use it myself. I use nutrients like panethene, vitamin C, and so on. I've used it a lot in the past, and I just don't find it to be all that helpful. DHEA, I like 7-keto-DHEA, which is a metabolite that does not convert to estrogen, so I like it better for men and women for that reason, because it doesn't get involved with the potential for hormones. DHEA for a guy like you, Mike, is less of a problem. At 50 milligrams a day, you're going to absorb about half of it, which is about, it's a fine dose if you want to take that. No problem there. We use it in like male plus, the 7-keto DHEA. And we use a little less of it in the female plus. But, the DHEA is important. You've got to have it or your adrenal glands will get fatigued. And if the adrenal glands get fatigued because you're lacking DHEA, you will gain weight a lot easier. So that's a good supplement for that purpose. Women, not you, Mike, but women have to be concerned about just taking plain old DHEA. They start to get a little nervous when they start growing hair in wrong places. It's not a great supplement for women in very high doses at all. Sherry says, I read your article on the delusion of bone drugs. Makes sense to me. I'm not yet 60, and I have had multiple fractures of the lumbar and thoracic vertebrae. My doctors have pushed for bisphosphonates, to which I have had problems. Now I'm considering Reclast and Forteo. What I've read about Forteo is that it encourages the balance of osteoclasts and osteoblasts. I'm taking much better care of myself, yet the fear factor remains. Well, Sherry, because you've had fractures in your spine, there's no question that you have an issue. And, you've got to bend over backwards to get really good bone nutrition into your body. Of course, I recommend things like the Daily Bone Excel and Bone Helper, which has a lot of bone strengthening compounds. You may need other things like Strengthener Plus. You've got to make sure you're adequate in iron as well. Your fingernails should not have any of those vertical grooves in them. Your nails should be nice and strong. They're a good short-term indicator, but you've got to really boost up your nutrition and then be active. And, of course, vitamin D is very important, especially, Forteo, it's a synthetic parathyroid hormone. The biggest issue with this is the lack of vitamin D. You want your vitamin D levels tested by your doctor, and you want to make sure you're getting enough. You've got to make sure you're getting at least 2,000 units a day. And with your history, you might need a lot more than that, but you really should get a test for it because that's important. Reclast, wow, that's a nasty medication. That's a tough one because the FDA is stonewalling everyone on that one. It's a once-a-year shot, but it's got a very high risk for sudden cardiac arrhythmias that are so serious they cause death in 1% of the people and up to 3% of the people who take it. This one, 3 out of 100 wind up in the hospital from life-threatening arrhythmias. It's just not the drug of choice, Sherry. But you do have problems, so you got to have a whole comprehensive program. Your bones are not, there's no shortcut to bone health. You got to do the right things more often. Your bones will take wear and tear of your life. So when you're not yet 60 and you've had problems, you've probably been through some wear and tear. But the good news is if you can keep yourself active and be healthy, you still can grow bone back. Even at age 60, that's a good time to get going on it because you can add 1% bone density back a year if you can get everything going in your favor. All right, Heather says, my husband injured his knee about a month ago. The injury required surgery to repair. Following the surgery, he developed a blood clot in his vein of his calf. The doctor has now placed him on Coumadin for 6 months. Are there any supplements that I can safely give him to restore and support his body while he's going through this? Well, certainly, the best ones would be Cardio Helper, which will stabilize inflammation within his circulatory system and improve the circulation in his calf, and Repair Plus, which will naturally help clean up tissue damage and clean up debris that shouldn't be in his circulation system. And with the Cardio Helper, that's fine at 3 or 6 a day. Repair Plus is a somewhat of a blood thinner itself, although not by the same mechanism as Coumadin. And so normally I would recommend a dose of 2 to 6 a day, but you might have to just do 1 or 2 a day to get started so that the Coumadin dose doesn't get out of whack. But since you go in and monitor that, you can tell if you're getting too much or they have to adjust the dose. But Repair Plus will actually clean up the problem and help speed up his recovery. So Repair Plus is a really good in that situation along with the Cardio Helper. Tracy S., my brother has a high platelet count. I am curious what could be the cause of this, what are possible outcomes if not addressed, and what can be done to normalize it. Well, Tracy, While there can be various medical issues relating to high platelets, the number one reason for high platelets, just for having high platelets, is inflammation. And so anything he would do to lower inflammation would help. That's anything. So it's better lifestyle, it's better amount of sleep, it's less wear and tear. The nutrients I just mentioned for Heather, the Repair Plus and the Cardio Helper, are wonderful for circulatory reduction in inflammation. A nutrient like pantothene has been proven to restore energy dynamics to platelets and get them to function better. When you get them to function better, they flow better and everything works better, and then the high counts, they don't stay high. So a lot of times once platelets start getting inflamed, then they don't get recycled correctly, and then you end up with extra of them. And then if you pull out a medical textbook and look up high platelets, you go down this list of diseases that hardly anybody has, but yeah, you might have it, and you wonder what's going on, and you just don't know, and most people don't have that anyway, but you know, bottom line, inflammation reduction, Tracy. All right, last question of the day comes from Nick, who says, I stretched my ACL in my right knee a few years ago. I was told by doctors that this ligament cannot heal itself. Is this true? And are there any supplements that can help? I had to drop all pivoting sports and forced to wear an ACL brace if I attempt to do any pivoting activities. Well, Nick, it is true that if you pulled the ACL away from the bone, it wouldn't just reattach itself. Doctors like to think that if you tear it, it doesn't fix itself. The truth of the matter is it's a slow healing tissue. It's not a, because of its, it's not as flexible, say, as your skin or some of your other tissues. And so ligaments can be healed, but they're slower. And it's kind of like cartilage. It's a slow turnover tissue, meaning it doesn't heal real fast and it doesn't recover, but it can. So the nutrients that help an ACL would be tissue healing nutrients, glucosamine, chondroitin, sulfur. Of course, hyaluronic acid would be top on that list. And then the anti-inflammatories that help bring down the inflammation and speed up the healing process. So a product like Repair Plus. So you could combine, you know, hyaluronic acid, skin rejuvenator, Repair Plus, or the whole rejuvenation pack, which is handy and convenient and gives you comprehensive coverage for lots of tissues. The problem is it's not going to heal within a week or two. I mean, even if it's been a few years, what you actually have to do is saturate a dose to the point where you can notice there's less pain and less inflammation. Sometimes it's good to go and have some body work done as well. You get somebody that's good at pressure points or elbows in your knees and or your soft tissues there. Because a lot of times with these ACLs, you have compensation where you have a lot of sore spots. The ligaments have tightened up. The muscles around the area above and below the knee have tightened up. They need to be loosened up by somebody that can help unlock it so it's not as problematic. So sometimes some physical therapy is good with that. And then once you're getting the nutrients into the area, it will start to improve gradually and slowly, and you can start doing more and more. But you probably still, if you're pushing it a little bit more, you see what you can get away with. A lot of times you'll see within 3 to 6 months of adequate nutrition that it is a lot better. You still may want to use a brace for certain activities just to be on the safe side, because if you tweak it, and it will tweak easier than it did in the past, you'll sort of say, oh, I'm right back to where I was, and that's not so good. But Nick, it can heal, it's just slower to heal, and so that's the problem, is people are anxious to get back out doing things too fast. But as you see, after a couple of years, if you don't do much of anything, it doesn't get that much better. So you want to get it loosened up, you want to get it nourished. After a couple of years, I'd probably recommend some body work from somebody that's good at that, and you should be back on track, Nick. All right, well, I'd like to thank all of you for sending in your questions this week, and if you have a question that I can help you out with, please email it to me, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. That's it for the podcast this week. Have a great week, and I'll be back next week.
The Weekly Wellness Update podcast is produced by Wellness Resources Incorporated, copyright 2008, all rights reserved. For more information on the topics and news covered in today's podcast, visit wellnessresources.com. To email Byron a specific health question, send it to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The information presented in this podcast is for informational purposes. It is not medical advice for the treatment of any condition or illness. You should not use the information in this podcast for diagnosis or treatment of any health problem or to discontinue the use of any medication that has been prescribed to you. Consult your physician or healthcare professional for such needs. Statements made during this podcast regarding any Wellness Resources dietary supplement products have not been evaluated by the FDA. Wellness Resources dietary supplement products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.